Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to talk about a bad robot, J.J. Abrams-Lindsay Weber production, 10 Cloverfield Lane. But first, let's talk about some news, shall we?
We shall. Let us.
All right. So this isn't really news. It's news about news that we need to look forward to. But San Diego Comic-Con is coming up.
Which neither one of us is going to.
No. Have you ever been there?
No.
Me either. No. I want to go. I want to go so badly, but getting tickets is damn near impossible these days.
Closest I ever came was when we watched Paul for commentary Trek Stars.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Me too. Me too. Yeah, I don't know. You know, for those people who don't know, San Diego Comic-Con is definitely the biggest comic book convention in the world, and every year... What happens in Hall H is basically a bunch of studios make announcements about upcoming projects. It's like a 4,000-seat room or something like that. It's multi-thousand seats.
Pretty crazy.
And they trot out all of their big-name stars, and they make huge announcements. Like a couple years ago was when they dropped the news that Man of Steel 2 would be Batman versus Superman, and everyone was like, oh my God, oh my God. You know, this is the type of stuff that goes on in Hall H, you know? And Saturday in particular. I mean, Friday's big, but Saturday is the day. And I mean, this is a big deal. Like, people, like, if you want to get into Hall H, you're lining up the night before, you know?
Yeah.
This is what people do. This is the centerpiece of the convention. And, what happens on Saturday in Hall H is always a big deal. Everything in there makes the news. And this year, on Saturday, July 23rd, the day after Star Trek Beyond premieres, which also that premiere is going to be at Comic-Con this year.
Indeed it will.
Yeah, even though they've already shown it twice in other parts of the country, this will be the world premiere because, you know, if it doesn't happen in America, it doesn't happen in the world, I guess.
I believe that you have just summed up the 20th century.
So, July 23rd, there is going to be a Star Trek 50th anniversary panel in Hall H.
You know, I don't typically get all jazzed about panels I'm going to miss. I'm kind of like, yeah, you know, whatever. Like the Batman versus Superman announcement, everyone's like, oh, we saw the logo. I'm like, you know, I was happier watching it on YouTube, honestly. I mean, like, you know, okay. But yeah, this is a panel I would love to see. Like, just the names on it are, I mean, it's insane. You know, all the representation across the different generations that they're going to have for Star Trek are, you know, that's pretty crazy, man.
Yeah, going down the list, we've got William Shatner.
Yes.
Scott Bakula.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Dorn. Mm-hmm. Jerry Ryan.
Yes.
And Brent Spiner. So really, someone from each series, when you think about it. That's kind of how it plays out. If you count Dorn as, you know, Deep Space Nine, as you should.
Yes.
So these people are going to be here to chat about Star Trek, and it's going to be hosted by Brian Fuller.
Yeah.
Okay. Now here's the thing. Let's just read the description on this one, and so that, you know, you can see how they're promoting it, and then we'll analyze. Join William Shatner, Scott Bakula, Michael Dorn, Jerry Ryan, and Brent Spiner for a conversation moderated by Brian Fuller, executive producer of the new Star Trek television series coming to CBS All Access following its network premiere in 2017. So all of that is kind of saying that this is about Star Trek's history, right? This is the 50th anniversary, and it's just moderated by Brian Fuller, you know, in the same way that Kevin Smith is moderating the Preacher panel, you know?
Right.
But let's put together some other little things and see what may possibly definitely be going on here in
what
Hall
H. Hints they could be giving us.
Well, I think the first big hint is back when there was the Saturn Awards a couple weeks ago, and Brian Fuller was in that press line, and Scott Weintraub from Collider was grilling him. One of the questions that Weintraub asked was, when are we going to start getting some more information about this show? And Fuller said something along the lines of, probably around the time of San Diego Comic-Con. Yeah. But then also, I mean, let's just look at what it means to be in Hall H on a Saturday, right? They don't give this slot to anyone. Let's just look at the lineup for Saturday in Hall H. 11:30 to 1:30, Warner Brothers panel, okay? 2 hours of Warner Brothers talking about their new movies, and they've already said they're going to have the cast of Wonder Woman, the cast of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the cast of Kong Skull Island. It's like they're bringing out all the heavy hitters, okay? This is where you're probably going to see your first Wonder Woman footage. You know what I mean?
No, I think they've confirmed that you are going to see your first Wonder Woman footage.
Yeah, this is a big deal, okay? That's a huge panel. That's how they're starting. Then at 2 o'clock is Star Trek, okay? At 3:15... Aliens 30th anniversary, which seems a little weak until you realize that James Cameron is going to be there, you know?
That's amazing, and I hope that he talks about the movie and not Avatar.
And, you know, I mean, you get James Cameron, Sigourney Weaver, you know, Michael Biehn, you know, all the way down to Lance Henriksen and Carrie Henn, and, you know, Paul Reiser is going to be there. It's like, yeah, that's Hall H worthy, even though it's not going to be a big announcement. Fox is pimping their new 30th anniversary of Aliens, you know.
Blu-ray, well, and also revive and interest in the franchise, because you got the whole, you know, Blomkamp thing and all of that stuff, and Ridley Scott thing going on right now.
And who knows? Maybe they will announce the Blomkamp thing is like moving forward or something. You never know, right?
Yeah.
So there's that. Then 5:30 is Marvel. You know, where they've already said you're going to see your first footage from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and all this stuff. Huge, right? And then the day ends at 7 o'clock, as is traditional, with a Kevin Smith, you know, Q&A. That's how Saturday always ends in Hall H, right? So, okay, one of these things is not like the other, because as huge of a name as William Shatner is, okay, like a few years back, I was at Dragon Con, and William Shatner's panel was in some sort of satellite room in a basement at like 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, right? I mean, you can literally like walk down the street and find a convention that William Shatner is speaking at, right?
That's a good point, yes.
This is not Hall H worthy. But you know what is Hall H worthy is announcements about this new Star Trek show, which starts shooting in a couple months.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, is the simple fact that this is a Star Trek panel that is not in any way focused on, yes, you have people who were in the movies based on the series and everything, but these are all the TV stars. This is all very television centric. Like, I read these names and I don't think, oh, Star Trek Beyond just came out. I think, oh, this is all about the TV series, and that would be a perfect way to play into, well, we've gone through, and here's a taste of what's to come, and take a look at that.
Yeah, and I mean, even Chris Pine literally is going to be in that room a half an hour before this panel, and he's not there, because he's going to be there for Wonder Woman. And all those Star Trek movie people are going to be down there for Beyond, right?
Yeah.
So, but no, this is about TV, and Brian Fuller moderating. They're announcing something. Who knows?
I agree.
Who knows if they'll bring out the and this is traditional for, you know, San Diego too, is to be like, we're doing this. I mean, like, I just saw a conversation on Twitter between a bunch of like film journalists where they're like, I once sat through a panel for the upcoming film Let's Be Cops, because I thought that there might be information or new footage from the new X-Men movie that was coming out the following year. There wasn't, you know, but I mean, that is a traditional thing for them to do, is to be like, oh yeah, come and see this thing about this insignificant thing. Oh, and here, you know, I mean, It could be any of a million things, or maybe nothing, but it could be anything from here's the title and the premise to let's introduce you to all of the new stars. Like, it could be that.
I don't think we're going to get any of the new stars because it's only an hour-long panel.
Yes, that
would be too big a reaction, and they've got all of these people to speak to. But I think that you're very, very much on the right track, were I to guess, in that they will announce what the format is, how they're going to be approaching the story, what it's going to tackle, and is it possible that they have all of the different generations here? And so they'll be like, well, you know, here's this timeline, and here's these people from this timeline, and these people from this timeline. Our timeline is, and, you know.
It could be that. I don't know. All I know is, like, here's the thing. I've never been to San Diego, like we were saying, right? Mm-hmm. But technology now, Twitter in particular, has gotten to the point where you can virtually experience Hall H at San Diego from the comfort of your own living room. And I've done this the past few years, and it's gotten to the point now where, like, I will even not work on the Saturday of Hall H so that I can literally sit at home and look at my phone, you know, because you just start following a bunch of film journalists like Slash Film, Collider, you know, all those guys, you know, all the usual suspects, and you just update, and you do get a live tweet, like literally, of what's going on in that room. Because everyone in that room is live tweeting it. So if you want to hear the news as it's happening, get on Twitter, start following a bunch of film journalists, you know, everyone from your favorite movie website. You know, I would recommend Slash Film is really good. Slash Film and Collider, those are definitely really good. I'm assuming that, you know, some of the Star Trek sites will have people in the room as well. But just sit on Twitter. At 2 p.m. on Pacific time on Saturday, July 23rd. And I would be shocked and extremely disappointed if we don't get some news about the new show at that point.
I think it's a lock. I think you're right. I think that it's a lock. I think that the only reason, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons to have it focused on the television series stars for that hour is to lead into, oh, and Star Trek is coming back to television, and there you get, well, television of a sort.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they can, you know, I mean, you know, if they wanted to, they could certainly talk about, you know, examine, you know, well, Shatner, you were network, and, you know, Dorn and Spiner, you were syndication, and, you know, Jerry Ryan, you were part of a show that was trying to launch a network, and Scott Bakula, you helped kill it. So now we're on to the app. So.
All of it has led to this, yes.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. I'm excited. I'm super excited about this. You know, there's a lot of Star Trek people who are going to be at San Diego promoting other things. You know, Brandon Braga will be there for Salem. Brian Fuller will be there for American Gods. You know, they're even going to be showing the pilot for Time After Time. So, the following day, Manny Coto will be there to talk about 24 Legacy. So, you know, check it out. You know, there's going to be a lot of interesting, cool news coming out right after. Because it's like, and this is the thing which I think is so exciting about this, right? Like, we're getting to see a new Star Trek movie next week. Like, a week from today, we will have all seen this new movie. And yet, you know, when you're just coming down off that high, I mean, last time we saw a new Star Trek movie, it's like, great, that was great. Now we've got to wait 3 years for the next one, over 3 years for the next one. Now here, the very next day, we're probably going to get a crap ton of information, or at least some tidbits about this new show.
Yeah, we'll be primed and ready.
That's exciting. That's very, very exciting. It's Star Trek week next week. You know, I mean, one of the biggest weeks in Star Trek history, potentially. So
for once, the other star franchise is going to dominate things.
Yes, for sure. For sure. All right. Well, should we move on to our feature for this week?
Let's do it.
Okay. 10 Cloverfield Lane. Now, on our predecessor, Commentary, Trek Stars, we did a series looking at the movies which J.J. Abrams produced for other people. And while we were in the middle of that series, it was revealed that there was a new movie which he had produced for someone else, which was coming out very, very soon. And that movie was 10 Cloverfield Lane. This is a movie which is a pseudo-sequel to Cloverfield. Yep. Abrams produced it with Lindsay Weber. This is her first movie that she has produced as, like, you know, just straight up producer. She's the woman who runs Bad Robot's film division, and she's also one of the producers along with JJ on Star Trek Beyond. Mm-hmm. So we thought before Beyond comes out, we should probably check back with JJ Abrams and see what else he did, you know, right before that. So 10 Cloverfield Lane, you want to give a synopsis of this thing?
Yes. Woman is involved in a car accident, and when she wakes up, she is in a bunker where the gentleman, John Goodman, who has taken her from the car, has insisted that the world outside has ended. The world as we know it outside has ended, and they are looking at least at 1 to 2 years in this underground bunker that he built, because he was a prepper, and he anticipated the world ending. And then there is another gentleman in the bunker who helped him build everything and knew to come there when the world was ending. And so he corroborates the idea that the world is ending outside. But she is left wondering, is she part of a scam? Are they putting her on? And what's the real deal? And so the whole movie is her coping with that and being a true J.J. Abrams movie. The whole thing is about the mystery. Well, I mean, it's not a J.J. Abrams movie, but something produced by J.J. Abrams, it's not surprising that the whole thing is about the magic box. What is the reveal? What is the secret?
Yes, that's very much true. So what did you think about this
loved
movie?
It. Thought it was great. The ending of it, I didn't have any problem with it story-wise. I didn't feel that it gelled as well as it could have, but it wasn't like a overall negative. It wasn't enough for me to be like, oh, that's a disappointing, like, but the real power of the movie, the real driving force, is that whole central conflict with being trapped in there with John Goodman. That focus of the movie is so incredibly riveting. Like, I couldn't stop watching. It's a totally different type of suspense from the original Cloverfield, because in the original Cloverfield, it's like, oh, these creatures, and how are you going to get away, and what's going on, and everything's first person, and oh my gosh, what's happening? And that's what's putting you on the edge of your seat, where it's like an old thrilly monster movie, whereas this is old school suspense of like, what's going on? What's everybody's real story here? And who is being honest and who's lying? And so there's almost like a Hitchcockian feel to it of it's a real character play, and it's three people through the whole movie interacting, like Reservoir Dogs comes to mind, where the whole power of it is these people relating to each other, and everybody's got their own motivations and decisions about whether to trust and go along with things or not. So I loved it. I thought it was great. What did you think?
Yeah, I loved it too, for a lot of the same reasons. I mean, there is this question for sure, like, what's going on? What is it that happened? Did anything happen? All that stuff. Why are we here even? But all of the suspense comes from what is happening in that room. And, the performances are key to all of that. Mary Elizabeth Winstead is fantastic. She's always so good. She's oftentimes underutilized, but here I think this is like maybe her best performance. She's fantastic. Mm-hmm. and the whole movie hinges on her, but she's playing off of John Goodman's performance, and John Goodman is amazing. I mean, I don't know what it is about John Goodman. Like, you see him in everything, and he's always different in everything, but at the same time, there's something about him which just has this sort of like tangible nature. He really, really, really reminds me of someone who I know, and it's almost like I'm watching that person on screen anytime that I see John Goodman, like a lot of his sort of like mannerisms and tics and, you know, speech patterns and everything are very similar to this person. And I'm just like, oh my God. And because of that, it feels so real. I mean, most of the thing, like this person, you know, he wouldn't build a bunker in his basement. But at the same time, if he told me that he was doing that, I'd be like, yeah, yeah, I can see that, you know? And I feel the same, I feel the same way, even though it's a very different character in some regard, in some ways, I feel that same way about like Walter from The Big Lebowski, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, John Goodman, he knows exactly what he's doing as an actor. He is in complete control of his craft. And he is so good at sort of like finding the meaning behind dialogue and exploiting that to its full potential. I mean, there's like this one scene where he's like, if you enjoy films, I have them over there on that shelf. I have a number of DVDs and VHS video cassette or VHS cassettes, I think is what he says.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're going to watch them, please return them to their sleeves. And everything about that is so spot on. The fact that he calls them films, the fact that he has both DVDs and VHS cassettes, the fact that he refers to them as VHS cassettes, and the fact that he wants to make sure that they are returned to their sleeves, right? All of that speaks so much to that character, and yet Goodman's delivery of it is key, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I completely agree. He reminds me of somebody that I may or may not have known in my life, but not so much in the mannerisms as I believe that this person, if they were a little more motivated, would have a bunker underground somewhere. But this person that I'm thinking of just didn't have his focus and determination to do that. The funny thing, you mentioned the movies. When he's watching Pretty in Pink, the first thing that jumped out to me, and I blame you for this, first and foremost, he's watching on a 4x3 TV. I mean, come on, if you're going to build a bunker, you know, come on, man. At least get an anamorphic, you know, get it 16x9. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just because you're living in the apocalypse doesn't mean you have to live like a savage. I mean, come on. But then also he's watching it, and the first thing that pops out at me is pan and scan. Come on. If you're living in the apocalypse, at least get what the director of photography intended, you know? Yeah. Like, come on.
That's I mean, I thought that when he's like, I have him on VHS, I'm like, why didn't you upgrade? Why don't you have Blu-ray? But at the same time, that's what this guy would have, you know?
Yeah, okay, that's a fair point.
I think that it's definitely true to the character that he would have VHS cassettes. And that
because entertainment would have been the priority, not being a cinephile. Like, right. it wasn't important. Like, he would assess entertainment as a necessity of survival as opposed to a pleasure to be indulged in.
Yeah.
Like, he acknowledges that this is the type of guy that would acknowledge entertainment as simply something you need to do so you don't go nuts and kill everybody else that you're with.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a utility to it that he's coming from. Good point. Good point.
He's really good. And I mean, the writing in this is extremely good, too. And I know that it was, you know, developed by a couple of guys. It was an outside pitch. But someone who is credited, you know, co-credited with the screenplay, who I'm assuming did a substantial amount of work on it, is Damien Chazelle, who is a writer-director who most recently did a film called Whiplash, which was nominated for Best Picture, and which was the best movie of 2014. If you haven't seen Whiplash...
I have not.
Oh, my God. It's so good.
I have heard nothing but great things about it.
And there, I mean, you want to talk about, like, actually a very similar character, you know, in a lot of ways. J.K. Simmons' character as the teacher in that movie, which he won an Oscar for. Very similar to John Goodman's character, very similar to John Goodman's performance in a lot of ways. Damien Chazelle, I kind of see as sort of like the heir apparent when it comes to, auteur-based filmmaking. When I watch Whiplash, I see early PTA, early Paul Thomas Anderson at play, and I am more excited about his career, seeing what he has to offer, than any other young filmmaker who's just starting. Although, you know who's close? Hmm. Dan Trachtenberg, the guy who directed this movie.
This is his first movie.
I know.
Are you kidding me? Right? Like, I mean, usually your first movie's a mulligan. Uh-huh. Like, you even go back to my much-revered George Lucas. You go back to the original cut of THX-1138, you're like, oh, yeah, okay, you came out of film school, all right, and you know how to put, all right, yes, all right, show me what you can do next. Or, you look at just about anybody. It's that Fincher, Alien 3, is the universal mulligan. Everybody says, yeah, well, you got to ignore Alien 3. Like, everybody gives him a pass on that. This is Trachtenberg's first movie. That's amazing to me. That's for a director to make something so suspenseful and get the performances that he does out of his actors. Like, that's a testament. That's super good skill right there.
Yeah, all that's good. We've talked about how good, you know, the writing is, how good the performances are and everything, and the suspense, and you know, he's able to maintain all that through a lot of things. But the other thing which I was really shocked by, and I guess it you know, leads into all of this stuff too, is the photography, the compositions in this movie are so great. You know, like, whereas the first Cloverfield movie, a very different movie, shot all with handheld cameras, looking like they were, you know, home videos, you know, just chaos, you know, at play. This movie is shot in anamorphic widescreen, even though the entire thing takes place underground in a bunker.
Yeah.
It's shot in these huge vistas, these, you know, tableau shots. And, you know, it's all very, very carefully composed and choreographed and edited together in such a way that it has, like, this beautiful formal quality, very similar to Hitchcock, like you were saying, you know. And for a first-time director to come out of the gate with something that sophisticated is extraordinarily impressive, you know.
Well, yeah, and the sense of place that gets created visually is like, I feel like I've been in this bunker. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't feel like a movie set. It doesn't feel like camera tricks. It doesn't feel like, well, wait a minute, if this room, you know, it's so easy with something like this to say, well, wait a minute, would this room have been here or would this room have been here? Wait, this doesn't quite line up. There's no sense of that. Like, I feel that I've lived in this place with them at the end of the movie. I feel like I was there. There's nothing artificial about it. That in and of itself is amazing.
And while you're watching it, you have just enough sort of like peeks into the outside world, and the way that you get the information about what's going on outside is the same way that the characters do, that it really sort of lets your imagination wander in the same way that the characters' imaginations are wandering in terms of, you know, what it is that's going on outside of that bunker, which is really cool.
Well, and it's also, you know, maybe it's Goodman's performance, I don't know. But I found that the engaging question, the truly brilliantly engaging question from the get-go, is if you find yourself in that situation, you wake up after you've been in a car accident and you're in this room, what is your first reaction going to be?
Yeah.
And I think that it's a testament to Goodman's performance that when he first walks in, I don't know whether it's me or whatever, but I didn't doubt him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, my initial reaction, and I, you know, I think that this has to do with, you know, the performance and the sense of place and the way everything's put together is, like, he walks in and he, you know, oh, well, you know, there's nobody to call, the world, you know, it's like the world's over, it's all, and I just take him at his word.
Yeah.
When you think, but then, and then I step back and I'm like, no, how could you take him at his word? You know, like, I'd be trying to get out of there too. You know, like, but there's this moment of doubt, and it's not forceful. It's not contrived. It's you're legitimately left with the question of how would I react in that moment? Mm-hmm. Am I going along with this? Do I believe? Do I find him to be a truth teller? And I think it's just, it's amazing. Because it, through the entire movie, you're like you said, you're sitting there and you get information the way that they do. And when you do see outside, and that is not spoiling anything, because they show in the previews that you see through like the little window because there's a door and everything. It's brilliant. I don't know whether it's because they sized the window properly or the way they shot it or a combination of both. But I was going nuts because I wanted to climb through that window. I was like, I got to see what's on the other sides. I can't see anything. I can't, you know, like, and I think the claustrophobia of the entire setup comes through in those moments. Yeah. When she's face to face with the door and can see outside and still can't tell whether he's full of it or not.
Yeah.
You know, like, those are brilliant moments.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked before about gear shift movies, you know, movies which change in the third act and become something else, or maybe before the third act, you know, movies like Psycho. This is definitely a gear shift movie, without a doubt. Without getting into spoilers about what happens at the end, what did you think about that shift in gears?
I thought the shift in gears was a little bit longer. It took a little bit longer to complete than, and the thing is, since we're trying to stay out of spoiler territory, I didn't have a problem with the gear shift, but after the gear shift happens is where I think it took a little bit longer to continue developing than it should have.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying with that?
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved the gear shift in this movie because it basically becomes a different movie. It's one of those things which I think a lot of gear shift movies try to do. And I've heard a lot of people criticize it for that. Like, oh, all of a sudden it becomes a different movie. And I'm like, yeah, right? Right?
You are a fan of that. I will say that this works better than other gear shift movies you've been a fan of.
I will say that if you're a fan of John Goodman and you're a fan of gear shift movies, if you want to see a movie which is extremely good and shifts gears like nobody's business and has an amazing John Goodman performance in it where he's doing something which you've never really seen him do before, check out Red State by Kevin Smith. It's amazing.
You have me right up until the buy part right there, and then all of a sudden I've disengaged.
Just, it's not, I mean, you will watch, if someone put it in front of you and said, who's the director on this, that you would never in a million years guess it was Kevin Smith.
Yet I do know, and it works against it. It's a funny world we live in, Mike.
Just watch it. It's awesome.
I see that or Batman versus Superman Ultimate Edition?
No, there's no question at all that you should definitely see Red State, because any version of Red State is a million times better than any version of Batman versus Superman.
I'm reporting you to Matthew Rushing on the Trek FM network, Mike.
I liked Batman versus Superman. What can I say? But Red State, I think, aside from Chasing Amy, and I'm going to say Clerks just because it was such a big part of my life, Red State is Kevin Smith's best movie. It's insane. It's insanely good. The craftsmanship involved is outstanding.
If there's anything that our on mic relationship demonstrates, you only have another 8 to 12 months to convince me to finally rent it. So keep hope alive. Keep working on it.
All right. Okay. I'll do that. All right. So quickly, sorry, because we're running long, I apologize to everyone. How do you think it works as a Cloverfield sequel?
It does. It in my head, because the thing, I can't go into it, because if I go into it, why it does for me work perfectly as a Cloverfield sequel, I spoil the ending. But there is a very specific thing that makes it work as a Cloverfield sequel for me. And so, yes, this is Cloverfield 2. It's not Cloverfield 2, but it exists in that world.
It's Cloverfield T-O-O, two.
Ooh, see? That right there. That is perfect.
But You know, a lot of things that they've been saying in the marketing and everything, which I think is accurate, and which I think is sort of like the intention of this, even though it was sort of like retconned into being a Cloverfield movie. It does fit. Cloverfield is a monster movie. You know, it's not. I mean, it is a science fiction movie and all that stuff, but at its heart, what it is a monster movie. Like Godzilla is a monster movie, or King Kong is a monster movie, and the idea here that 10 Cloverfield Lane is also a monster movie, but the thing which you slowly learn over the course of the movie is that John Goodman is the monster, you know, that I think is really cool. So yes, I think that I agree that it does work as a Cloverfield movie. And I think that it's pretty great that they made it a Cloverfield movie, because anytime that anyone connects anything to anything, I love it, just because that's me.
The connected universe is a thing that we enjoy on Stage Nine, for sure.
Yeah, and you could say that it totally fits into Star Trek continuity, because there's Slusho, and Slusho is in Star Trek, so there you go.
And it fits into Super 8 continuity, which therefore fits into Star Trek continuity by default, because the Kelvin gas station.
Yes, and Heroes continuity, too, because Slusho is in Heroes. And is Heroes part of the Fullerverse? I don't know. But
the Fullerverse. Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. So many connections.
Yeah, I know, right?
It's the Brian Fuller, J.J. Abrams multiverse.
Right, because, you know, Brian Fuller, getting off on a bit of a tangent, Brian Fuller's shows are all, like, in the same continuity. He has his Fullerverse. So, I mean, everyone's like, is it J.J.-verse? Is it prime timeline for this new show? Nah.
The Fullerverse is a terrifying place if Hannibal takes place in it.
It does. But the idea that both, like, Hannibal and Wonderfalls take place in the same continuity, that's pretty awesome. And maybe Star Trek now, too. One can only hope. All right. So, yes, this was produced by J.J. Abrams and Lindsay Weber, and, you know, they're part of Bad Robot, and we've talked about how, you know, J.J. Abrams, you know, has sort of a style and trademark for the things which he didn't direct but has produced. Do you say that this fits in with those?
Yeah. I do. Yes, it works.
I agree, because, I mean, I think the thing that we found, you know, in our other series was that Bad Robot productions have a certain quality associated with them. If you see something is produced by Bad Robot, you know at the very least that you're going to get something which is well made. And this is extremely well made. And I think that it really does speak to them as producers that they recognized this talent, you know, this guy who I think he did like a Portal fan film, and that was like his big calling card. And they were like, yeah, let's get him to direct this movie. Yeah, let's get the guy who wrote Whiplash to come in and, you know, rewrite it, you know, and they really sort of saw all of these pieces. They knew that John Goodman would be great, as always. They knew that, you know, Damien Chazelle can write his butt off. And they knew that this new guy, even though he had never made a movie before, could put it all together into something that's like this. And it's not exactly like this is an easy first film to make. This is extremely complex. And he hits it out of the park. It's insane.
And, agreed.
You know, tip of the cap to Abrams and Weber for recognizing all of that talent and putting it together into, I think, one of the best movies of the year.
I agree. It's stunning to me that this is a movie that slipped, you know, under the radar the way that it did. I think it deserved much more success, and especially as I compare it, as we're getting into summertime season fatigue, I'd love more 10 Cloverfield Lanes than more superhero blockbuster movies at this point. Dead serious. Yeah. I want more of these, please.
Yeah. Well, hopefully now that it's out on video and you can, you know, rent it off of iTunes and all the usual places, hopefully more people will discover it and check it out and, you know, enjoy it for what it is, which is great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been fun talking about 10 Cloverfield Lane, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
The DNA of Star Trek fandom and I've said it before, fandom existed, fandom enjoyed the show, but the main charge of fandom was to get the damn thing back.
Warp 5.
The Romulans had their ship in season 4 that had the holograms that made it look like any other ship. So you could theoretically retcon Minefield into saying they were using that same technology back then.
Literary Treks.
We have a long tradition here on Literary Treks of taking things seriously and having a good time while doing that. Tonight, well, we were going to take it seriously, but then the comics wouldn't let us.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, I had a similar experience where, you know, I was talking to a guy, the new movie's coming out, obviously, and I'm like, have you seen the first one? And he's like, no, I haven't. And I'm like, okay, well, let me bring it to you so you can take a look. And he watched it, and he came back the next day, and he's like, oh, yeah, that movie was really good.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. Star Trek Beyond next week.
Almost here.
You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for our other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download all the MP3s from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Before we go, we'd like to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter and Chris Steftenagel, for supporting the show. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, as always.
If you want to support the show like Jeff and Chris, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM. You can also find the network at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you?
Kessel Junkie on Twitter. Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, another podcast. And then on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing over on the Nerd Party Network. And where can people find you, Mike?
You can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and you can also find me right here on Trek FM producing From There to Here, Trek FM's daily rewatch of Star Trek, in which we look at all 729 episodes over the course of the 50th anniversary. All right. Well, that's it for 10 Cloverfield Lane. Next week, I know that we're releasing it the day that Star Trek Beyond comes out, and because of advanced screenings, everyone will have seen it by the time it comes out. But instead of talking about Star Trek Beyond next week, since, you know, we need time to record a show on Star Trek Beyond, we're going to be talking about Star Trek directors.